everyone, welcome back to But Why They're the Podcast, and today I have a special interview with the director and writer of Swallow from IFC Films, Carlo Mirabella Davis. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for speaking. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited. I got to check this out at Fantastic Fest 2019, and it's about to start its theatrical run on March 6th. Are you excited for people to, you know, get to see this?
Oh my God, I am beyond excited. I cannot wait for this film to go out into the world and for people to experience it. It's a story that's very near and dear to my heart, so I'm just so honored that IFC, this company that I've long admired, has decided to put the movie out. So, yeah, can't wait.
So along those lines, and hearing you say that it's near and dear to your heart, my first question has to be, what inspired this story?
Yeah, so the film was inspired by my grandmother, who was a homemaker in the 1950s in an unhappy marriage, who developed various rituals of control. She was an obsessive hand washer who would go through 4 bars of soap a day and 12 bottles of rubbing alcohol a week. And I think she was looking for order in a life she felt increasingly powerless in. And my grandfather, at the behest of the doctors, put her into a mental institution where she was given electroshock therapy and insulin shock therapy and a non-consensual lobotomy. And she lost her sense of taste, smell, because they botched the operation. And I always felt that there was something punitive about it, that she was being punished in a way for not living up to society's expectations of what they felt a wife or a mother should be. So I wanted to make a film about that. But hand washing is not very cinematic, you know? So I remember seeing an image of all the contents of a patient with pica's stomach that had been surgically removed, and these little artifacts were spread out on a table like an archaeological dig. And I was so fascinated. I wanted to know what drew the patient to these objects. It almost seemed like a holy communion, like something mystical. And I wanted to know more.
Wow. It all makes sense now. I was very curious when I saw the film. Like, this is a very interesting take on, you know, a disorder that we really only see in, like, My Strain, you know, I'm using quotations, you know, that show, like, My Strain's Addictions. And a lot of the times, when they showcase disorders like this and obsessive compulsions in that way, as much as it is a documentary, docuseries, they don't tend to show us the weight of it, the trauma of it. I think one of the beautiful things you did in Swallow is you always feel that there's something under the surface. There's never a moment where it just feels like, oh, we're just doing this for shock. When it came down to kind of bringing Pica to the screen and figuring out what the objects would be, how did you figure that piece? Like, did you know that you wanted specific pieces to be involved that she would swallow? Or did that just kind of evolve as it happened? Did you take any inspiration?
You know, this is a film about small things, about talismans, keepsakes in a way. And so it was very important to me that every one of the objects would be fiercely specific. That each object that Hunter consumes is a kind of emotional memory. It has its own emotional flavor, if you will. And the marble, for example, if you listen to the sound design, you can hear people laughing on a beach with birds wheeling overhead, and the look in Hunter's eyes suggests, you know, that she's recalling some nostalgic moment of joy from her childhood. And there's something about the marble itself that's kind of magical.
Yeah.
It's prismatic. It, you know. Whereas the thumbtack is a completely different emotional texture, more like a dangerous liaison.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we wanted each one of the moments of her consuming the object to be preceded by some kind of event that would trigger her need to go to the objects. And I'm so glad you felt that way about the film telling the story in a careful manner.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe strongly that it's important that these kinds of stories be told. And a lot of times when stories of compulsions are put on the screen, the narrative is all about the person erasing the symptoms rather than examining the reason that it's happening and the potentially restrictive environment or oppressive environment that the person is in, which may have a contributing factor.
Yeah, and I think you did very well in kind of showing us not only Hunter, but also showing the world that she lives in and really building out how she lacks control. When it came to detailing the characters, specifically of her husband's family, how did you go about deciding what roles they would each play?
It's a really interesting question. Well, of course, you know, we were so incredibly fortunate that the brilliant Haley Bennett decided to bring Hunter to life.
Yeah.
Haley is so amazing with layers of emotion. And Hunter wears multiple masks throughout the film. There's that first mask, that placid smile reflecting what her husband wants her to be. There's that second mask, her pain, her doubt, is this where I belong? And the third mask, you know, her true self, her primal self emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And Haley can give you all those masks simultaneously, which with just the touch of her hair or the twitch of her eye. So a lot of how the story is told, you know, we see reflected through the micro details of Haley Bennett's, face.
Yeah.
As far as the family is concerned, I wanted each one of them to, in a way, reflect a different aspect of the patriarchal system that was confining and containing her.
Yeah.
So there's the father, her father-in-law, who has a sort of Trump-esque, you know, aura to him.
Yeah.
You know, played amazingly by David Brash. And, you know, there's that oblivious oppression that he has about him. You know, the father's so dismissive of her in this casual, offhand, couldn't be bothered kind of way that I think, you know, reflects that sort of penultimate power structure.
Yeah.
And then there's her husband, Richie, wonderfully played by Austin Stoll. Who is kind of a Don Jr., you know, kind of character.
Yeah.
You know, being brought into the company in an act of pure nepotism that he does not, you know, earn. He is someone who is, you can tell, is very eager to live up to his parents' expectations and fulfill this kind of alpha male concept that he's desperately pursuing.
Yeah.
And he, you know, we see that he sees Hunter as an augmentation to his life. She is there to cheerlead him on, and she's kind of this ornament that he keeps contained within the house. And, you know, within him, Austin did such a great job of, like, lacing Richie with, like, a kind of innocence and childlike quality, and we see some tenderness he has for Hunter, but it's always in conflict with, you know, his privilege, you know, which comes out at every minute, you know, as he's controlling and containing her. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the mother, amazingly played by the incredible Elizabeth Marvel, who is just, you know, wonderful. She represents that a woman who has been, who is sort of like what Hunter was, has been absorbed into the power structure, is part of it.
Yeah.
And is enforcing that patriarchal power structure, but is also aware of the pains and restrictions of it, and sympathetic to Hunter as well. As at the same time, she's containing herself. You know, I'm so pleased that those amazing actors decided to bring those roles so clearly into focus, and then of course anchored by Hayley Bennett's out of this world performance.
Yeah, there wasn't a single moment where where the tension didn't feel real or like something that I could see somebody experiencing, or something that I have experienced myself. Like there was so much nuance where it wasn't campy, but it was very forward, but it was also very authentic. So that was, you did an amazing job, especially writing their relationships to each other and building that out.
Thank you.
One of the other things that really struck me of the film is the way you shot it is there is an intimacy in almost all of the moments, whether it's between Hunter and other characters or it's between Hunter and her objects. And one of my largest questions kind of after watching was, how did you decide how much to show of some of the more, and I don't want to use the word violent, but some of the more detrimental aspects, right? So like how she eats the objects, or how the objects come out, how she, when she collects the first marvel, when she collects the marble, which is the first one that she swallows. How did you choose how much to show? How did you balance, blood and the pastels? Because it is very nuanced and intimate. That was one of the things that struck me.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. I love that interpretation, the use of the word intimate. I think it's really what we were going for, that you would be ushered into the internal cosmology of Hunter's world and anchored through her experience. I was very fortunate to work with the visionary cinematographer, Caitlin Arzmendi, and we spent a lot of time discussing, creating this rigid vernacular for the camera direction. Kate and I worked on the idea of a set of rules that we would stick to, where if you watch the film, you see that in a lot of Kate's framing, Hunter is sort of lost in the frame, or that the frame is very locked down and formal in the beginning of the film, especially when Hunter is on display with relatives and other people.
Yeah.
And then when Hunter has these key emotional moments of clarity, Kate will suddenly introduce handheld, or will suddenly use a close-up, or in the moments that Hunter is alone, that's when Kate will use, shallow depth of field. And Kate came up with this amazing idea of shooting on Master Prime lenses, which capture the world with such stark texture, because Pica is very textural.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had an incredible design team. Aaron McGill, who is an unbelievable artist and has such a specific imagination and understanding of color, brought in this idea of the colored gels that Hunter puts up in the baby's room, which was one of my favorite scenes, where you see, because Hunter is decorating her house, that she's decorating the house the way she thinks this wealthy family would want, but then parts of her true self and personality come through, like in that moment with the red gel, where you feel this sense of her true persona emerging. And of course, our incredible costume designer Leanna D'Ambrosio, is so good at bringing out people's psychological arcs to what they wear.
Yeah.
But in terms of your question about what to show and what not to show, it was it's a tightrope walk with this kind of material. I always believe that audiences' imaginations are so powerful that oftentimes less is more.
Yeah.
And an audience will fill in the the blanks. I'll never forget when one of our audience members fainted in a screening at Tribeca.
Oh, wow.
During one of the sequences. And I went out to see if she was okay and talked to her, and she said, I just couldn't stop thinking, feeling what was happening, you know, in my mind. I felt it very intensely. And so I realized, yeah, that the mind, you know, can show a lot. Having said that, I also wanted to make a bold film that didn't shy away from putting things on the screen that I felt were important for an audience to see. And I didn't want to sanitize the story too much. So, because I think it's important. Hunter's rebellion, in a way, and she's rebelling against that sanitized world she's living in. And by embracing and taking control of her body, she is upending the patriarchal system she's in. So I wanted to pay homage to that as well. So I hope we hit the right balance, but it was, you know, it was Kate and I storyboarded every single sequence. So we, you know, we tried to hit the right marks for each one.
Well, I will say from my perspective, I thought you all balanced it wonderfully. Yeah, there were, I didn't faint, but there were definitely moments when I saw it for the first time in the theater where I got really uncomfortable really quickly. And then we would jump out of it. I was like, okay, I can and calm down a little bit. But then I noticed that, especially with the sound design and the choice of music, especially when she is in that where she's kind of found her power in swallowing these objects, where she hits that stride before her family finds out, where like I notice that we're kind of riding this wave with her. Everything is really from her perspective, almost in the sound design piece and the perspective, and we're moved with her. But saying that, to kind of give us what is going on in her space and understanding where she's situated in the world, it's really dark, right? Like there's a lot of emotion and trauma buried there, but it's juxtaposed against this very bright pastel filled world. How did you manage that balance of making sure that people understood the emotion while also visually showing something that is really uplifting almost in the pastels or in the colors that she wears. But you can, I don't know. I don't know if that was a very long-winded question or one that was thought out.
No, it's a fascinating question. And it's something that we spend a lot of time discussing. And I love this question. I'm fascinated by the idea of counterpoint. That concept, which I think I first encountered in Blue Velvet, where you see this world that seems perfect on the surface, and then you go down into the grass and see the bugs lurking underneath. I love films that have a stylized surface, because in some ways it allows you to engage with more disturbing material. I think the slight bit of dark humor and the slight pastel wash over the film makes the medicine go down a little easier. I think if we'd made the film in a hyper-realistic way, it would have been harder to engage with it. And there's something so human about the way that Hayley Bennett plays the story, so authentic and honest. And I believe in that idea of making a film with heart and with psychological clarity, so that even if the story is disturbing, you have an anchor, someone to hold on to, an empathy with the main character. I also have to say that a lot of this work is being done by the score, the incredibly beautiful score by Nathan Halpern. Is in a way a character unto itself. He evoked a lot of Douglas Sirk kind of Hitchcockian energy with his beautiful orchestral score. But then we would lace it with these little metallic textures that would reflect all the objects. So I think a little bit of that Sirkian score, a little bit of that Hitchcock, you know, energy allows the audience to go on this journey. And then, of course, the counterpoint that you see in the beautiful pastel production design, you know, it reinforces the theme, that idea that a lot of things which are being sold to us in the world as, you know, the American dream all of us should be pursuing are sort of corrosive underneath. There's something sinister lurking behind that, you know, notion of what success and power and happiness is. And so I think the film kind of reflects that through that counterpoint.
Awesome. Well, I have loved talking with you, and I know we're running a little long. So my last piece is just, what do you want people to walk away from your film feeling?
You know, this is a movie that at the end of the day is about a woman who is in a situation where everyone is telling her that this is what should make her happy, that this is who she is, and that this is what she should want. And she accepts it at first and represses her true feelings in a way. She swallows her emotions and her true self in order to fit into the patriarchal power structure she finds herself immersed in. And even though the compulsion is dangerous, the pica, it serves as a kind of catalyst that allows her to start a private rebellion that, like a pebble tossed down the hillside, becomes an avalanche and draws her to what, who she really is and what she really wants. And I hope it's a film that's empowering and makes people feel seen. I believe that genre films, that horror can change the world. I think because genre films are so visceral that they can kind of startle us into this emotional catharsis. And I'm very inspired by all of the amazing films that are being made right now in the genre space, like Get Out and Babadook and Hereditary and so many other films that, you know, are bringing important social issues into the realm of genre. And I hope that Swallow is one of those movies, and I hope that even though it is an intense experience, that it's a heartfelt one, and that it makes people feel connected to the character and makes them feel like there's an empathy and a warmth and a shared experience there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. Why don't you let everybody listening know how they can follow the film, how they can follow you if you're on Twitter or Instagram, any of those socials. Let us know what we can do to, you know, keep watching the film or like where the film's going.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the film is being released by IFC Films on March 6th. It will be in theaters and on VOD. You can follow me on Instagram and you can go to our website, swallowmovie.com. And I hope that if people like the movie, they tell others about it. Word of mouth is very important for movies to expand our audience. So and I hope people enjoy it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking with me, Carlo. This was really great, and I really enjoyed the film.
Such a pleasure speaking with you. I really appreciate this opportunity to discuss it.